Well, we have been studying the book of Zechariah, and we are also in the Christmas season of celebration. And you might be wondering, how do we put those things together? Well, just be reminded that the birth of Christ did not happen in a vacuum. And this book is preparatory to what is coming. It was a prophetic word that the Lord had given prior to the Messiah's coming, and it has to do with the Messiah's coming as well, as we will see. So we have considered the first two sections of the book of Zechariah. The first section consisted of eight visions regarding Israel's near and far future, chapters 1 through 6. The second section presented four messages on Israel's failures and future blessings, chapters 7 and 8. And now we are coming to the last section of the book of Zechariah, and it contains two undated oracles or specific prophetic words from the Lord that are almost entirely eschatological. Not totally, but a lot of it is looking forward to the more distant future. So they expand on the visions that were given that also had eschatological, that is, future last things significance, as well as the messages that were in chapters 1 through 8 that we've already looked at. They will sort of modify the things that had been communicated that were maybe more of an optimistic view and include something of Israel's purification that is necessary in the process of preparation for the last time. So there's a variety of things that are going to be included here. And it's understood that these last chapters of Zechariah 9 through 14 were probably composed after the temple was completed, in terms of that's some more information for us to consider. Something else to think about is that the phrase "on that day" occurs 18 times in these last six or so chapters and points to the distant future. And that's also clear from the contexts that are given here as well. So the centerpiece of this section is the Messianic King who will appear and bring both judgment and blessing. Now, these chapters are, interestingly, the most quoted section of the prophets in the gospel narratives. So this last section of Zechariah is going to be found referenced in the gospels on many occasions. One commentator pointed out, just as the eight night visions, chapters 1 through 6, and the prophecies springing out of the question regarding national fast, chapters 7 and 8, have their fulfillment in events leading up to and into the kingdom, without an exception, so chapters 9 through 14 likewise comprehend the same great messianic future of Israel. So there is clearly a messianic emphasis, that is the anticipation of the Messiah's coming. And we see, when we look at the details, that there's two aspects to that that needs to be considered. And if we don't have a proper eschatological understanding, that is, viewing the last things from a consistent premillennial dispensational understanding of the book of Isaiah, or a book of Zechariah or Isaiah for that matter, it can seem somewhat obscure. But if we have the right grid by which to think about it, it is helpful. Another commentator, this one is probably familiar, J. Vernon McGee. I know some of you have hit him as your favorite. We shall see the two comings of the Messiah in chapters 9 through 11 and then chapters 12 to 14, coming first as the Savior and coming second as the Sovereign. His coming the first time had the cross in view. The second coming will have the crown in view. So that's just, again, kind of pointing out some of the elements that are involved here. And then the first of these two oracles indicates much change that is coming. That's looking at chapters 9 through 11. Judgment is coming on Israel's enemies, chapter 9, verses 1 through 7. But Israel will enjoy deliverance, chapter 9, verse 8. Amid much blessing, chapter 9, 9 through 10, 12, Israel will also experience sorrow. Chapter 11 includes that. The promised messianic king will come, but he will be rejected. Well, we can look back and we can see how all of that had transpired. So this chapter is going to be dealing with the destruction of nations, preservation of Zion, the advent of Messiah, and deliverance and blessing of Israel. So it really covers a number of different aspects. So we're going to look at the first of those, the first section, chapter 9, verses 1 through 8, the destruction of nations and preservation of Zion. And I sort of deliberately went with division of the text in an outline that was more descriptive of the content of the text in much of some of these writings, because you can get lost in the details. And if I came up with some cutesy phraseology that might make it a little more applicational, you might lose the bigger picture. So I'm going with this kind of designation, the destruction of nations and preservation of Zion. And then looking at the text, verses 1 through 4, the burden of the word of the Lord against the land of Hadrach and Damascus, its resting place, for the eyes of men and all the tribes of Israel are on the Lord. Also against Hamath, which borders on it, and against Tyre and Sidon, though they are very wise. For Tyre built herself a tower, heaped up silver like the dust, and gold like the mire of the streets. Behold, the Lord will cast her out. He will destroy her power in the sea, and she will be devoured by fire. Obviously, that sounds more like a judgment kind of situation. So we see here a prediction of judgment on nations of the north, and it's helpful for us to see, well, there's a designation of nations around Israel at this time, and these are specifically to the north. The first part of this chapter is a prophetic pronouncement of judgment, and it is in poetic form. And that sometimes is helpful to realize, because some of the way things are stated can be better understood if we realize, oh, we're dealing with a poetic form here. So the first four verses of this poem deal with the nations of the north. The last four deal with nations to the south of Israel itself. The first two verses and the last two include some element of deliverance that's sort of built in to some degree. And the middle four speak of judgment more particularly. The passage begins and ends with references to eyes, the eyes of men in verse 1 and the eyes of God in verse 8. Just an interesting, again, observation. The Lord had a burden to, or had sent a burden to Zechariah that announced judgment and blessing. The word burden here means heavy pronouncement. The Hebrew is masah. It's not a real common word, but it does show up periodically. You can find it in 2 Kings 9, 25 to 26, Jeremiah 23, 33 as some examples. It's the idea of a weighty word from the Lord, something that has some element of heaviness to it. And so this is a weighty prophetic message that concerned lands to the north of Israel. They included Hadrach. Another variation of this is Hatarika, which is north of Hamath. Hamath was on the Orontes River, and that's a city in Aram, which we'll see is Syria. Amos 6:2 refers to it. Damascus was the capital of Aram, or Syria. And then Tyre and Sidon were Phoenician cities. They were on the coastline, and they were between Aram and Israel. Ezekiel 26, 3 to 14, and 28, 20 to 24 deal with them if you want to do a little bit more research on those. The order of these cities in the text is from north to south. So it has a sort of a progression that is in view. in terms of their location. Earlier prophets had seen enemies invading Israel from the north. Isaiah 41:25, Jeremiah 1:14-15, Ezekiel 26:7. So now Yahweh would take the same route, destroying Israel's enemies as he came. And we'll see there's somebody in particular in mind that the Lord is going to be using to accomplish that, but he's identifying essentially himself as the one who is orchestrating things in some form or another that may be beyond our grasp as to exactly how he brings that to pass. Originally, the Mediterranean coast was designated to be Israel's territory. Numbers 34, 5, and 6 deal with that. But it was never really possessed by Israel in that upper area there. And now at last the Lord is going to claim it for his people in due time. So this revelation concerned a time when all the people of the world, especially the Israelites, would be looking toward Yahweh. There would be a sense of anticipation, a recognition. This prophecy is also understood as having a near fulfillment, because this is when Alexander the Great conquered these nations, which was part of his plan for world dominion. And he had some pretty big ideas, and he was relatively successful in bringing that to pass. So much so that he's been called Alexander the Great, because he made some great progress toward his goals. He just didn't live long enough to see it kind of come to ultimate fruition because he was involved in things that were not particularly healthy. But it was also the Lord's larger plan to present judgment and future blessing, but he was using Alexander the Great as his instrument to accomplish his will. And there would be a greater fulfillment of this prophecy that would come in the more distant future that goes even beyond Alexander. But there are some things that we know from history that this passage alludes to. That is that Tyre had trusted in the physical fortifications that it had put into place in her defense, and had accumulated various stockpiles of silver and gold for her own security, which is not unusual for nations to do. And she had also built a 150-foot wall around the city, which was on this island that stood just offshore of into the Mediterranean, off the western shore there. And that was because Nebuchadnezzar had made some siege attempts on this island and this nation, but they had sort of moved onto this little island here. And but he didn't totally conquer the city, and so they had put up fortifications to withstand anything like that in the future. But now Alexander the Great's going to come along, and he's going to find a way to make that change. So even though Tyre had gained a great amount of wealth through its commerce, it was not going to continue in any significant time frame. So the Lord is now indicating that he's going to dispossess Tyre and displace her wealth, essentially casting it into the Mediterranean Sea. The parts of the city that would not go down into the water would be going up into flames. And so that's kind of what the picture is communicating here. And so Alexander the Great destroyed Tyre by building a causeway from the mainland to the island, and then he leveled it. And this devastation is specifically referenced in Ezekiel as well. So essentially, Alexander the Great finished what Nebuchadnezzar had started but wasn't able to bring to completion. And it took a while. It took a little bit of determination to build that causeway out there and then bring it to conclusion. But the Lord knew all of this ahead of time. And he anticipated it. He predicted it, and was, in every sense that we can understand, orchestrating it as well. Then looking at the next couple of verses here, verses 5 and 6, we read, Ascalon shall see it and fear. Gaza also shall be very sorrowful. And Ekron, for he dried up her expectation. The king shall perish from Gaza, and Ashkelon shall not be inhabited. A mixed race shall settle in Ashdod, and I will cut off the pride of the Philistines. Several years ago, when I had occasion to go to Israel, I had the opportunity to go to Ashkelon and Ashdod. For some reason, we didn't go to Gaza. I don't know why that would be, but no, just kidding. But it was interesting to see them now, and they can picture, you know, what took place in those locations. So we see here a prediction of judgment on nations now to the south, not way south of Israel, but just barely toward the south. So there were a few Philistine cities that were identified for judgment. We recognize that designation, the Philistine area. These cities were further south along the Mediterranean coast, whereas Tyre and Sidon and the others were, again, further north. But they were in that basic vicinity. And so they may have observed what was happening with Tyre, you know, Alexander the Great coming down and building a causeway out there, and it might have made them just a little bit nervous. Of these cities, Ekron was the most northern of them, and then there was Ashdod and Ashkelon and Gaza just going down that way. There was also a fifth city that isn't mentioned here that was part of what was referred to as the Pentapolis, the five cities of the Philistines that were noteworthy there. That other city that wasn't specifically mentioned here was Gath. You may remember Goliath was from Gath, so that would be a familiar one. But it had lost any significance by the time of Zechariah and his writing, and so that would seem to explain its omission here. So God would destroy these cities, and he would populate them with a mixed group of citizens, which we would recognize is the case today, and perhaps with more significance even in the future that has yet to take place. But he's in the process here of humbling the pride of the Philistines. They had been an enemy of Israel for many, many years, as we think about David and Goliath and all of the things that were associated there, and Saul and various other times. But they've also fell under the influence of Alexander the Great when he continued on south, because Alexander essentially had his eye on Egypt and was taking pretty much every place on the way down there. And so, again, his exploits are prophetically anticipated here as part of God's plan that includes an element of punishment, his active discipline on other peoples that are recognized here. Then looking at verse 7, I will take away the blood from his mouth and the abominations from between his teeth. But he who remains, even he shall be for our God, and shall be like a leader in Judah and Ekron, like a Jebusite. So we'll have to think about what exactly is that talking about. So we continue looking at prediction of judgment on the nations of the south. The cause and results of this judgment are identified. The Lord would remove the blood that these pagans had eaten from their mouths. As we know from the biblical record, the Israelites were forbidden from eating blood, and that was passed along even after the church age. So it was an expectation to not continue that. He would take the unclean, detestable foods that they ate from their mouths. That's the picture that's indicated here. But what we need to recognize is that part of the Philistine pagan worship involved drinking blood and eating unclean food. So likely that pagan activity was in view, particularly here, and so therefore judgment was going to be taken upon them. There would be some remaining Philistines who would turn to the Lord and become like Israelites in their faith in Yahweh. So there's a somewhat of an evangelistic anticipation here. The reference to the Jebusites is also significant. The Jebusites had been incorporated into Israel in David's day. They would have some involvement, some place, but they were also to some degree in subjugation to them. And so the Philistines would also have a comparable relationship in the future. So there would be some good that would come from this judgment, because there would be some responsiveness to the Lord as well. And what it reminds us is that the Lord always has a bigger picture in view. Even when he's involved in bringing judgment, he sees what's going to be taking place in the future, anticipates, deals with that accordingly. Then verse 8, I will camp around my house because of the army, because of him who passes by and him who returns. No more shall an oppressor pass through them, for now I have seen with my eyes. That's the Lord's analysis of the situation. So the Lord promised to protect his people and the land. The imagery here is protection as if a band of soldiers was there in dealing with enemies that they would be facing, that would be opposing them. The reference to house here is probably used in a figure of speech form of metonymy, the whole, speaking the part for the whole, looking at the whole nation, the whole people, as we would talk about the house of Israel, for instance, that kind of designation. At a future time, it would be the case that no enemy would oppress them ever again, because the Lord had seen their plight and he would defend them. So this promise of no more oppression anticipates the second advent of the Messiah. It would be under kingdom rule at that time, again, looking toward the future. So Israel is going to be indebted to the Lord for his care for them, for his preservation. Even at the time of Alexander, it's interesting that there was some sort of preservation that was given at that time. This section of prophetic description of Yahweh's march from the north, again, he did so using Alexander the Great. He was going down from the north to the south. Again, he had his eye on Egypt. He was taking things as he went. History shows that the Lord was using Alexander as his agent to accomplish this particular task. Alexander had been involved in defeating the Persians, 333 B.C., and was now, again, making his move toward Egypt. And on this march, he took out the Aramean interior, including Syria, and then he went along the coastline and took those nations that we've already referenced. And then on coming to Jerusalem, he refused to destroy it. Josephus reports that Alexander had a dream, and because of it, he decided to spare Jerusalem. That would seem to suggest that there was some particular supernatural intervention at this time. And that would certainly seem to be the case. So this first section of the book, a section of this last part of the book, has some important facets to it. The Lord's victory is certain, and he intends to bring back to himself his people that had long been alienated from them, or bring a people to himself. And so he is in the process of bringing things to the purpose that he has. So this is going to lead to the future where there's going to be a culmination of universal worship of the King, who is the Lord of hosts. Chapter 4, verses 16 to 19 made reference to this. And again, all of it indicates that the Lord is unfolding his plan to ultimately draw people to himself. Not just Israel, but that's his main focus, but it's going to be reaching out from there. So with that in view, then we move to the next portion here, the provision of the king and restoration of Zion. So verse 9 says, and this is again a very familiar verse, "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. He is just and having salvation, lowly and riding on a donkey, a colt, the foal of a donkey." So here we have the prediction and anticipation of Zion's king. This text is one of the most messianically significant passages in the Bible, and that's true for both the Jews as well as the Christian traditions. Judaism sees it as the basis for a royal messianic expectation. The New Testament and Christianity sees it as a text of prophecy regarding the triumphal entry of Jesus Christ into Jerusalem on the Sunday before his crucifixion in Matthew 25:5 and John 12:15 reference this in particular. So in spite of the maybe divergent interpretations between Judaism and Christianity, there is a unanimous conviction that this relates to a descendant of David that is in view here. And it speaks of one who, though humble, rides as a victor into the capital city of Jerusalem. So the idea is a way has been prepared by the imposition of universal peace, after which the king will exercise dominion over the whole world. And we recognize, while there is an immediate view in mind of Christ's triumphal entry, the reality didn't take place or has not yet taken place until the time of the end of the tribulation and the beginning of the inauguration into the millennial kingdom. Oh, not yet. The Israelites should rejoice greatly because their king was coming to them. So there was an expectation here. So the first part of the verse contains three figures of speech. Zechariah personified Zion and Jerusalem as daughters rejoicing and shouting. He named the city in place of its inhabitants here, which is a form of metonymy. He used the city to represent the whole nation, a synecdoche. And so recognizing that, again, the poetic form that's used here. So Israel's king would be a just ruler who would bring salvation with him. The world's peace depends upon a Messiah and his salvation. Now, if there's going to be peace, how is that ultimately going to be the case? When we think about the Christmas story, there's reference to peace associated there. When we think about the provision of salvation, there is peace involved in that as well. So this king would be coming, and there would be an element of humility, not being proud or boastful. And so Zechariah pictures this humble king riding on a gentle donkey. Now, there's some significance here as well. A donkey's colt was a purebred donkey, one born of a female donkey rather than of a mule, and that was understood to be a royal mount. In the ancient Near East, rulers commonly rode on donkeys if they came in peace. Some passages that you could check out on that, Judges 5:10, 10:4. 12:14, 2 Samuel 16:2, 1 Kings 1:33. When they rode into war, they would ride on a horse, like you'd refer to it as a war horse. So this gives one reason the Israelites should rejoice, that is their coming king. Their king is coming. And again, we recognize there are two Advents in view, and we are in the process of celebrating one of them shortly. There's also an interesting contrast here to think about. When Alexander the Great came, he inspired fear. When the Messiah comes, he's going to inspire joy. Joy that shall be to all people, what we read in the book of Luke. Then, looking at the next verse here, verse 10, I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the horse from Jerusalem. The battle bow shall be cut off. He shall speak peace to the nations. His dominion shall rise, shall be from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. So here we see Israel should also rejoice because of the establishment of the king's kingdom. If you are a king, you have a kingdom. There's the anticipation that is in view here. Some have observed that the entire church age fits between Zechariah chapter 9 and 9:10. And there's a sense in which that would be the case. His first advent, his second advent would be included there, just as is the case with Isaiah 9:6 and 9:7. And also, if you were to look at Isaiah 61, after the comma in 61 verse 2, again, the first advent and the second advent are distinguished, and there is a period of time there, a parenthesis, and we understand that to be the church age that fits into that particular framework. So the gospel writers believe that Jesus was this coming king, and they make a point of identifying him as such. They said he fulfilled only verse 9 at this time, not verse 10, because that was what took place during his earthly ministry. In the future, the Lord would end war in Israel, and he would establish peace in the world with his sovereign proclamation. When he comes again, if you look at, for instance, Revelation chapter 19, it's very clear he's coming on a horse, and he's going to be putting all enemies under his feet on that occasion. So there is a worldwide extent of the Messiah's kingdom that is anticipated and predicted here. There's a reference to the chariot, the war horse, and the battle bow. Those are representative of the whole arsenal of those things that would be used in warfare. There would be a destruction of those that would take place. There would be an end put to those. Yahweh would rule through his kingdom over Israel as king. His dominion would be worldwide from the Euphrates in the east to the ends of the earth. In both of these verses, Messiah contrasts with Alexander the Great, the king who initially fulfilled verses 1 through 8. And one clue to the anticipation of a twofold event, that is the Palm Sunday as well as the eschatological procession, is in the difference in the tone and the emphasis between verse 9 and verse 10. In verse 9, the coming one, though designated as king, was also described as humble and lowly. This would be not particularly appropriate for one who is that ultimate triumphant victor who would be coming, which is what verse 10 anticipates, that universal dominion. So again, there is a distinction that is anticipated here. So our understanding of this passage is legitimately dependent upon New Testament considerations, which help us to recognize the distinctions that are noted here. And so we have the advantage of being able to look back and see how some of these things have transpired and see how they fit together. And with the further information of Revelation that's given the progress of Revelation, we see that there is more that yet is going to take place. So it's not surprising that there is an element of ambiguity in the minds of some of those early Jewish sects at this time, like the Qumran community, because they were expecting two messiahs, because they saw two different aspects. How could you put those two together unless you have one where there's a time period in between? And we see that's how it ultimately came to pass. then, looking at verses 11 through 13. As for you also, because of the blood of your covenant, I will set your prisoners free from the waterless pit. Return to the stronghold, you prisoners of hope. Even today I declare that I will restore double to you. Now, if you were in the Sunday school lesson this morning, you might have heard something about double portion. There's an element of that would be in the background here as well. For I have bent Judah my bow, fitted the bow with Ephraim, and raised up your sons, O Zion, against your sons, O Greece, and made you like the sword of a mighty man. So again, some interesting imagery that's communicated here. The deliverance and blessing of the people of Zion. Messiah must destroy all enemies before he can reign in peace and deliver and restore his people. Psalm 110 also deals with this. So the Lord promised to set free those of Zion who were imprisoned by their enemies. He pictured this as taking them out of a dry cistern where they were captives, prisoners, kind of like Joseph and Jeremiah, who both ended up in something of a similar nature, Genesis 37 and Jeremiah 38. God's people had been in the pit, as it were, in Babylonian exile, but they would find themselves in a worse predicament in the future that they would need to be pulled out of. We would recognize that as the tribulation period. So from that pit, God would again retrieve them according to his faithfulness to his covenant promises, because he has made those promises. But that's not to say there isn't some element of discipline that's going to be taking place in between. The mention of the blood of your covenant refers to the practice of blood sacrifice to ratify the covenants. Both the Abrahamic and the Mosaic were ratified with blood sacrifices in a particular way and time frame. The Lord instructed these former Israelite prisoners of the nations who were now free to return to their stronghold. What was in mind there was return to the Lord himself. And this is referenced many times in other passages. This was a call for true spiritual responsiveness. That is, there needed to be a heart response. That's referenced many times. He himself promised to restore to them double of what he had allowed their enemy to take from them. This double restoration of joy pictures a complete restoration as well. And then so Yahweh, who is pictured here as the divine warrior, he would use Israel as a weapon to subdue the Gentiles, to put them in his place. Judah would be his bow, Ephraim his arrow that was fitting the bow, and the sons of Zion would be his warrior sword. And so this indicated that he was in complete command of Israel's affairs. He was guiding them. He would subdue their enemies. He would restore their losses. The Lord is indicating he's observed their trials. He's aware of what they have had to deal with, what they will yet have to deal with, and he will be there for them, and he would exercise every element of his concern for them, and he would bring restoration to them. And they could be confident in the relationship that they had with him, that he would be faithful, that he would follow through on what he had told them. And that is also an encouragement for us, because we are also in relationship with him as the bride of Christ, as the church, in a different dispensation. But yet we still have that relationship where we have his promises. We can be confident in him. We can trust him, take him at his word, and that's what we need to do. And that's what Zechariah was encouraging Israel to take into account as well. Then looking at verses 14 through 17. Then the Lord will be seen over them, and his arrow will go forth like lightning. The Lord God will blow the trumpet and go with whirlwinds from the south. The Lord of hosts will defend them. They shall devour and subdue with sling stones. They shall drink and roar as if with wine. They shall be filled with blood like basins, like the corners of the altar. The Lord their God will save them in that day as the flock of his people. For they shall be like the jewels of a crown, lifted like a banner over his land. For how great is its goodness, and how great its beauty! Grain shall make the young men thrive, and new wine the young women. So again, an interesting picture of things that are communicated here. So the Lord will show himself strong and defend and restore his people. That's been a kind of a recurring theme here. He will come against the nations like an army called to advance with a trumpet, a call to charge the enemy. He would be like a strong southern windstorm that could come through, and we know what those can be like in the desert lands. If you've traveled from southern New Mexico over into Arizona, there's a few stretches along there where there are multiple signs that say if there's a windstorm, sandstorm, get off the road, so on, beware. And they would have similar kinds of things there, that's emphasizing the strength of it. This verse was showing an initial partial fulfillment when the Jews overthrew the Greeks during the Maccabean revolt in the 2nd century B.C. But there would be a final, complete fulfillment at the time of the Messiah's second coming. So the Lord would defend Israel and would cause his people to be victorious over their enemies. The imagery here is of using sling stones. It may bring back, at least for some of us, an image of David dealing with Goliath. That's the most prominent. There are a few other references to utilizing sling stones. I think the people of Benjamin were noted for being left-handed, and they could sling a stone and hit, I don't remember what the target was now, but something very small, and be good at it. So that's, again, some of the imagery that's communicated here. And these people would be then emboldened by the sense of the Lord's defense of them. The death of these enemies would be essentially a sacrifice to him. Their shed blood is picturing the idea of an offering of appeasement that's given at this time. And the Israelites would experience deliverance and victory like a flock of sheep that's protected by their shepherd. They would be understood as, at least in the Lord's hands, as being precious and beautiful, as they are viewed sort of like jewels of a crown as they are in the land, having some element of glistening and observable beauty to them as they get to that place where there's a time of peace and tranquility. And they would then be viewed as being attractive, as exemplifying the Lord's goodness and the Lord's beauty showing through them. That's, the imagery that's indicated here. And then there would be the enjoyment of the best food and drink that would be available, and they would, as a result, flourish. That's the idea that's communicated there. So it's a beautiful picture of the Lord's restorative work, the things that are going to take place in the future. This is what his people have to look forward to. Even though they've had their ups and downs and would have more, yet the Lord is promising there's going to be ultimate fulfillment later, anticipating the first coming of the Lord and the second coming of the Lord. Both of those are in view. And this is going to be, again, expanded on even more. So there's what we would view as things that have already taken place, but yet many things have yet a distant, more future time frame in view, much more distant for them than for us. Obviously, we're much closer. But it was something that was to communicate a genuine hope. And when we think about the message of Christmas, how often is it not communicating a message of hope? The Messiah is come, is coming, has come from our perspective, but they were anticipating it. And there was an anticipation of many good things that are going to come from his coming into this world. And we have observed that, and we see there's yet more to take place. So we are encouraged, as Zechariah was encouraging his people at his time, we are encouraged to take heart, to trust in him in the present, as we also anticipate the future, as what we see is going to come. Now, we are not going to be participating in some of that which is spoken of here, for which we are very grateful. Yet, we have much to deal with. And there are things that are taking place in our own time that we wish we didn't have to deal with, but we are in the middle of things that are not going in a direction that we might want to have to deal with. And so there is the anticipation of some difficult times. But we are blessed because we are in a right relationship with God through the promised one, this Messiah who has come into the world and taken on human flesh and died on the cross and paid the penalty for our sin. And we simply receive that by faith in him. And so we have read, because we have his word, what the future holds for us as his children as well. And because the Savior has come in the flesh, as we are about to more formally celebrate, we can express our gratitude and appreciation for all that he has done and yet will do